first bill will open a public hearing on House Bill 2829, and Jeff Ross, please. And Ms. Ward, if you'd give us a rundown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2829 was sponsored by Representative Kropf, and it would create the offense of minor under the influence of controlled substance or inhalants. It would make that a violation with a maximum fine of $360, and a person under 18 years of age would commit the offense if they either knowingly consumed a controlled substance or inhalant, or if they were under the influence of either a controlled substance or inhalant. And, of course, the bill has exceptions for prescriptions or other sort of under the care of a doctor type exceptions. The bill also gives the authority to a school district board to require drug tests to reinstate a student if the board has a reasonable suspicion to believe that controlled substances were a factor in the behavior that led to the student's expulsion or suspension.
Thank you. Please.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Hello again. My name is Jeff Rost. I'm with the Oregon State Police Forensic Services Division. And I think I can probably, I did submit written testimony, but I think I can pretty much cut right to the chase on this issue, and that is that we're slightly concerned about language in House Bill 2829 that defines under the influence to mean that a substance can be detected in the body of a person by testing. We think that because this is a new offense, that law enforcement is likely going to be involved, and that law enforcement involvement will subsequently result in a urinalysis needing to be performed, and that urinalysis will likely occur in the forensic laboratories. And so we see that as being a potential fiscal impact to the Forensic Services Division, as it is work that we're not currently doing and may be required to pick up. And so that's really the extent of the written testimony that I submitted, is simply that we do see a potential source of fiscal impact. I will bring up one other point, and that is that the current language in House Bill 2829 with respect to the term under the influence does potentially create a conflict with driving under the influence statutes as they exist in Oregon today, in that currently for DUI, the definition of under the influence is not being able to detect that substance in the person, but rather, as you're probably aware, being impaired to a noticeable and perceptible degree. It is possible that in the hands of experienced counsel there could be that distinction drawn in court between these dual definitions, and potentially could undermine the current state of the law with respect to how we apply the term under the influence in driving under the influence cases. And so that does present some potential concern to us. But for the most part, my purpose here today is to simply bring to the committee's attention the possibility that because the forensic labs will be involved, we'll need to be doing work that we're not doing, and that's a fiscal to our division.
Okay, thank you. I'd like to ask you, just even though you're not testifying directly to this point, but with this just being a violation, how much problem is it going to be to require urinalysis testing? Mm-hmm. I mean,
well, it's a good question. Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, but there's a good question, because there are kind of some unclear issues in this bill that we're not really sure how to get our hands around. We don't know how many students, we assume this is coming from the perspective of Oregon's school system. We don't know how many students actually would be subject to this. There are no penalties associated with refusing to provide urine in this case, and so we're really not clear how many urinalysis samples we'll actually be doing, and there is the issue of the fact that we're dealing with a minor, and for all intensive purposes, a urinalysis is a search, and how we conduct that absent the consent of a guardian in this case. That's additionally a question. The reason that we're coming with a fiscal is that from the standpoint of the Forensic Services Division, we have to assume the worst case scenario. We do have to assume that there's going to be some additional work as a result of this, whether it's a little or a lot under the current system where we're turning away casework as it is. It's additional casework we're not doing, and so it's prudent, I guess, on our part to bring it to the committee's attention.
We appreciate that. Are there any other questions from the committee?
Well, I just have a little comment. I have a friend that her son was, she was just having big problems with him. He was smoking pot in their house, and she thought, you know, I'm going to call the police. They didn't do anything. They couldn't do anything, they said. So she couldn't even get her, as a parent, backup from the law to help her, you know, pound into this kid's head that this is a bad thing to do. And I just see it as a tool. I don't see that people are going to be walking around testing people unless they have been turned in such, you know, the instance I just stated to you. And it just adds one more tool to help head off problems later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher, that's very, you know, very likely could be the intent here. Is simply school systems don't traditionally like to be the hammer in these situations. They like to be they like to provide motivation in other ways if they can. And so I think you may very well be right. There is absent in this language, though, the issue of treatment. And I think that probably perhaps a better direction to go might be the possibility of introducing treatment into this as a possibility rather than legal or criminal penalties.
Well, actually, I wasn't even talking about treatment, just talking about this getting in. My friend could not emphasize to her kid, well, this is wrong, this is illegal, this is not something you should be doing, before he got addicted. I mean, he was just playing with it and basically thumbing his nose at his parents because they couldn't even get the law to follow, help back them up. So I'm not even talking about treatment at this point. I'm just talking about having her be able to do something that would help demonstrate the seriousness of the direction he was going.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not talking about getting him into treatment. I'm just talking about at least drug court, something where he can suffer some consequences or be held accountable for his actions at that point. Before it's too late.
Yeah. Representative Barker, Chair Barker, Representative Thatcher, I guess I really can't comment, I guess, on what the decision was of law enforcement in that case. It would seem to me that there are statutes already on the books that would have allowed for law enforcement to have some authority to take action in that case. I don't know that I can really comment why that didn't happen. It may have been a resource issue. I don't know. But certainly, from the standpoint of the Forensic Services Division, we don't get involved until law enforcement is involved. I don't have a good answer for you as to why law enforcement was not involved in that case.
So you're saying currently, that a minor under the influence of a controlled substance or inhalant, it is against the law, you're saying currently. And so really this...
Chairman Barker, Representative Thatcher, the current state of the law is it's illegal to possess a controlled substance regardless of age. This is dealing with being under the influence of a substance, but in order to use a substance, I would presume you'd have to be in possession of it first. There should have been an ability to act in that case as a result of the possession, I believe.
Okay, so what I hear you say is that maybe this isn't necessary because possession is already against the law.
Well, it wouldn't be legal inhalant. You can have an inhalant.
Perhaps, just to clarify a few things. Currently, although it is illegal to possess a controlled substance, there is a case specifically on point that states that possession does not include in the bloodstream. So if this child was only under the influence and there was no drugs found whatsoever, and I would include in that any implements to ingest the drugs that probably had residue, which would be prosecutable. I mean, any amount of a controlled substance is sufficient for a prosecution, arrest and prosecution. But just in the bloodstream would not be enough, and that's what I think this bill intends to cover, although then you get into another level of how are you going to prove it et cetera, et cetera. But that's what this bill is intending to address, certainly, is that simply being under the influence and not having it otherwise in your possession.
Thank you.
That sparked a question. Recalling back to a more innocent time when I was in high school and a wild time was to consume alcohol, I thought I remembered that one could be prosecuted for minor in possession of alcohol by reason of consumption,
yes,
even if you didn't have none of the alcohol otherwise in your possession other than in your system.
Representative McPherson, that is correct. You still can be cited for being a minor in possession by consumption.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Okay,
thank you. Okay, close the public hearing on House Bill 2829. I don't think we'll move that today. Next. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2833 from Representative Wisnett. When you testify, you can go in any order you wish, and if you just identify yourself for the record when you. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and honorable members of this committee. For the record, I'm Representative Gene Wisnett. And thank you for the opportunity to speak today on HB 2833. I would have brought my friend Representative Marsh up, but he's in the Education Subcommittee that I'm leaving right now to. So he is a co-sponsor of this bill. Both Representative Marsh and I have served on Commission for Children and Families. We're asking today to continue the current law which allows a waiver to use juvenile crime prevention funds for young children. This was outlined in Senate Bill 555 in 1999. And this portion of the law is set to sunset in 2005. We're not requesting new legislation, only asking to continue the good work that was started in 1999. Over the past 8 years, Deschutes County has made great strides in addressing public safety needs and establishing a community justice framework for youth programs in our community. You'll hear some specifics from my friends at the table later. In the current fiscal year, Deschutes County allocates over 70% of local juvenile crime prevention funds to serve youth in the targeted 11 to 17 age range through treatment foster care. This program is based upon performance evidence measures and outcomes. It currently supported under JCP Wage Joint Crime Prevention Funding Waiver in Deschutes County, which are highly effective and classified as evidence-based juvenile crime prevention programs. Since 1999, we've served over 2,000 children and families in different family parent training, home visiting, and homeschool interventions. And again, my friends at the table will give you more specifics in that and talk about those programs that have been highly successful in our community. Since 2001, Deschutes County has seen a 26% rate decrease in the rate of youth referred to juvenile community justice. In each of the past 3 years, Deschutes County has shown a reduction in the rate of repeat juvenile offenders. We have a program that's working. We're asking you to support that effort by approving this bill. You'll also, I think, have a letter of support from the governor, and you also have a letter from the Oregon Juvenile Crime Prevention Advisory Committee supports this effort. Since we introduced the bill, Mr. Chair and committee members, we're prepared to discuss an amendment to restrict this to Deschutes County only. That completes my comments. Thank you for the opportunity. Have any questions for me before the experts give you more details of how we've used this money for our community?
Any questions? Thank you, Representative Winston.
Thank you. Hello, Mr. Chair. Hello, members of the committee. My name is Tammy Bainey. I am a community volunteer as well as I chair the Deschutes County Commission on Children and Families. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today to dis- to discuss this bill. Again, in what Representative Wisnett had stated, we are requesting a continuation of the waiver that was set in 1999. We are not requesting new legislation. We are just requesting a continuation of the current waiver. We know that there are some concerns, and just as as Representative Wisnett had stated, we will be offering an amendment next week so that we can make this a Deschutes County only waiver. The language that is in the bill was actually arrived at in partnership with the JCPAC, and that was voted on in September of 2004 to support this bill as it is presented here today. So we found that that was a great partnership. This has allowed us to build a continuation of services based on our local comprehensive plan. We have been able to leverage the funds. We utilize about 30% of the funds that come into our county for this population of 0 to 8. 70% of those dollars are spent on 11 to 17. And again, I would just reiterate that a continuation of services has really been built, and we are making some great strides. Julie will let you know about some of the evidence-based practices that we've been able to put forth. We've been able to leverage 46% of that 30%, so we are able to utilize those dollars even to a greater value within our community, and we see the value in that. Again, we are looking for continuation only of this waiver, and we will be offering up an amendment next week for Deschutes only. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Julie Licky. I am staff at the Deschutes County Commission on Children and Families, and thank you for allowing us this opportunity. One of the things I want to discuss with you is the continuum of juvenile justice safety needs we have in our community. Over the past 8 years, we have built a 56-bed secure juvenile facility and shelter space. We've established a system of graduated sanctions, which also includes a long-term facility for youth residential program. We've increased the county general funds by more than $3 million annually. We have invested over $1 million in prevention, and that piece is part of the juvenile crime prevention money waiver that we've used, also other local resources that we've leveraged. So that's over $1 million in prevention for young children and high-risk families. And we also have established an annual report card to the community, which discusses specifically data relating to our juveniles. As Representative Wisnett discussed, our crime rates have been reduced, our repeat offender rates have been reduced, so we're very pleased with what we've done over the past 8 years in terms of looking at the whole continuum of services for our juvenile offenders. We don't believe that the waiver would provide an opportunity for all of the money to go to 0 to 8 year olds. The waiver allows us the ability to look at our system and to decide where money is needed at the time. As you can see, with 70% of the dollars going to the 11 to 17 year olds, which is the target population, clearly that's the first priority for us and where we look at the need initially. In terms of those programs that we're supporting, we've been very careful to choose evidence-based programs, and we know that's also a priority of the state. We want to make sure when we're spending our money on prevention, we're spending it on effective programs. We know it takes long-term solution to look at how to stem the juvenile crime, and so we're hoping with these evidence-based programs we will get there. Last year, just with these dollars in our home visiting program, 85% of the families reported an increase in positive parenting. In our school and home intervention, 75% of the children increased their adaptive behavior in class, and that means they were better behaved in class, they were on task. The interesting thing about this program is a lot of times they do a pre-test and a post-test with the children, and frequently these are the highest risk children in the class, and after they go through the program, they're actually better behaved than a lot of the kids that haven't been through the program. So they're not only improving their behavior, their academic engagement, but they're actually jumping beyond what the normal level in the class is, which is pretty impressive. In terms of our parent training, we also have 93% of the individuals report that their family management skills are improved. These are all outcomes that we look to for evidence-based programs that we know are proven to help reduce crime over the long run. So we're very pleased with the results of the program. We have submitted written testimony. We've also submitted a letter of support from our chief of police in Bend. Our local public safety people are very supportive of what we're doing and also are a huge part of our continuum of services for juvenile crime. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions?
Yes. Yeah, actually, I do. Why would we want to change it to just Deschutes County? It sounds like it's a good deal.
Thank you for the question, Representative, Mr. Chair. The issue we have is there are juvenile directors who are opposed to the bill, and we feel strongly about this bill, and so if it is something that concerns other juvenile departments, we're willing to do a Deschutes only waiver. Our juvenile department supports it. The written testimony we've submitted is actually from our county commissioners, our juvenile department, and our Commission on Children and Families.
Thank you very much, and thank you very much.
Thank
you very much for coming down, taking the time to travel over the hill.
Sure. Thank you.
See us. And I have Becky Eklund.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Becky Eklund. I work for the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission as the Juvenile Crime Prevention Coordinator. The Criminal Justice Commission administers these funds, and I'm the staff to the advisory committee that sets policy. In the fall of last year, the Juvenile Crime Prevention Advisory Committee reviewed this particular language and reviewed whether they were interested in supporting a continuation of this waiver opportunity and voted to support it. So I'm here today to let you know that the advisory committee was involved in the development of this language, working with Deschutes County, and supports House Bill 2833.
Thank you. I'd just like to ask you, you think this would be a beneficial program to other counties? I understand there's some reluctance for other counties to do it, but...
Well, I think it's important, and the advisory committee would agree that there needs to be services and supports for youth ages 0 to 18. These funds were specifically set for 10 to 17-year-olds who are at high risk of becoming involved in the juvenile justice system. So I think there's interest in continuing to make sure that that population of youth is receiving services so that all of this money wouldn't get shifted to some other population of kids.
Any other? Yes.
I just want to make sure that I understand in general how it works. The waiver is applied for by the county, correct? So a county that wants the waiver applies for it, a county that doesn't want the waiver and wants to just apply the money to 10 to 17-year-olds just applies the money to 10 to 17-year-olds. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
No, I'm just telling you. I'll get home.
And, Mr. Chair, before we close the public hearing on this, I did want to point out to the members that there is written testimony in opposition to this bill submitted by Tim Lowen, the director of the Yamhill County Juvenile Department. Mr. Lowen was not intending to sign up to testify, but did want his testimony noted for the record.
Okay, thank you. We'll close the public hearing on this and wait for the amendments to come in and talk to one of the lobbyists who said they have it all lined up, ready to go, sitting with you. And so we'll close the public hearing on that. Move it next week. Thank you. Okay, the next open a public hearing on House Bill 3012. Mary Botkin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Mary Botkin, and I'm here today representing the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. We represent a large number of workers in juvenile corrections, both at the state level and in local governments. House Bill 3012 and sort of its companion, 3071, if you will, start a process, in our opinion, which will allow us to more adequately identify those juvenile offenders within our system that have a diagnosed mental illness and start providing for a system of care that we believe is lacking And I think it's very important that we point out that we do not see this as sort of an agency problem. It is not a lack of willingness on the part of the Oregon Youth Authority to address these issues. It's a matter of resource allocations from other areas. And right now, what we see from our perspective is we watch the juvenile offenders working their way through the system, and the mental health needs are not being adequately met, and those offenders end up in the adult system, and it really doesn't matter at what point they become institutionalized. This is not a system that's working for folks, for the youth or for the adults who have diagnosed mental illnesses. I think that there is some wordsmithing that probably needs to be done on these bills. On 3012, I have to say that Legislative Council drafted it just the way we requested it, so I can't blame them. We think, in retrospect, that we probably need a different or an alternative outcome other than just returning youth back to a correctional facility, that there may actually be community-based services that are more appropriate for some youth than a correctional facility. And that was sort of an oversight, not an intentional outcome. I don't believe that the agency and our union are in opposite positions on these issues. We agree that this is a problem, that mentally ill kids in our system are a problem, and that we need to figure out how to appropriately handle their needs, stabilize their mental illness, focus them, and keep them on programs. We're just not doing it. And, you know, a couple of sessions ago, all we could hear about in this building was Kip Kinkle. You know what? Kip Kinkle had real smart parents. They turned over every rock they could find looking for services for themselves and their child, and they couldn't find them. Our system is failing people who need to have the services that can keep these kids stabilized. It wasn't that they didn't know their son was in trouble. They just couldn't find anybody to help. I would submit that OYA, and probably where OYA and I part ways, is that they depend on the mental health system and CSD or Children and Families to handle this and work in partnership with them. I don't think they do a very good job of it. I think OYA does a better job, and I'd rather see the resources within our system so that our workers have access to the appropriate level of treatment and housing needs that they can identify for the youth that they're responsible for. And it may or may not be institutional, but I think that we have good, solid, professional men and women working in this area, and they know better than anybody else what the needs are of the youth in their custody. And this bill just sort of starts that discussion. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Yeah, Mary, I'm just kind of curious, Mr. Chair, thanks. I'm curious, where does Trillium fit into this? I mean, with OYA, I had the opportunity to tour a facility down toward Corvallis last week and to see what they're doing with the youth offenders with mental health issues. I'm just curious your thoughts.
I mean, I think that Trillium is an example of one of the resources that we have available to us. The problem is we don't have enough.
Okay.
You know, the problem is not Trillium. The problem is that there's not five more Trilliums. And you know, being able to house youth in an environment that is safe, secure, and program-driven, that will hold a youth accountable while giving them the treatment and program needs that are required, is real. I think it saves us money long term. It doesn't save us money tomorrow, and it doesn't save us money in 5 years, but in 20 years, if we invest at this end, then the adult correction system becomes easier to manage and less costly.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary.
Thank you.
Angela Kimball and Phil Lemon. Morning.
Good morning, Chair Barker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Angela Kimball. I'm with the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs. I'm also a parent of a youth with a serious mental illness, and I really wanted to speak very briefly about my own experiences, because right now I have an 18-year-old who's going to college. He just got his acceptance letter. And for all of you for whom that's a normal experience, I have to tell you that it was just a few years ago when his psychiatrist was saying, you should let him get arrested. Maybe then he'll get the mental health services that he needs. He was diagnosed with bipolar disorder and severe ADD when he was about 13 years old. And I have to tell you, his psychiatrist saved his life and his whole family's. But it took 2 years to get the combination of medications that stabilized him. And during that two-year period, when he was a young adolescent, he ended up in the backup police cars. He ended up in psychiatric ER rooms. He ended up kicked out of school. He ended up in a diversion program. And he looked very clearly to very many people like he would be taken away from home and put in either psychiatric residential treatment or the custody of OYA. Today, he's at Cleveland High School. He's graduating. He hasn't been in trouble for years, and he's going to college. So I just want to give you that backdrop, because what it tells you is that a lot of youth with serious mental illnesses who can appear as though they belong in the criminal justice system, in fact, belong in the community. They belong where they can get appropriate treatment services. But unfortunately, not every child has a parent who's going to go to bat and do everything possible to get the right kind of treatment and to hang in there until life is turned around and somebody's no longer disabled by mental illness, but simply managing it. And Phil Fox and Mary Bodkin and I agree on this. Our youth today are ending up in the custody of OYA. When they grow up, they're ending up in jails, and they're ending up in prisons. This is why, as a community mental health program advocate, I actually work with Oregon Partners in Crisis, which is a criminal justice mental health coalition, NAMI, and others, to address these issues. This bill is a legitimate attempt to try and address the treatment needs of the youth that are ending up in custody who have serious mental illnesses. The rates at which they're ending up in custody are atrocious. They are several times higher than the rate in the community in general. This is a problem. We used to chain people to beds, and we called them lunatics. We called them insane. But today we're doing the same thing. We're keeping them in custody. We're keeping them isolated. We're keeping them away from the very things that could help them recover. And the long-term cost of that policy decision, is absolutely phenomenal. Every individual who is on disability is usually there for life, for decades. That cost is something people don't realize. When instead we can provide treatment and actually get youth to manage an illness as a chronic health condition, you have youth who are employed. My son has 2 part-time jobs. He will be a productive citizen. The alternative is in jail, in prison, homeless, on disability. That's a huge cost. As to this bill, the problem we have is not with the intent, which is to treat. Our problem is the following. We do not have appropriate resources for non-Medicaid children in our mental health system. I would agree with Mary Botkin that our community mental health system has failed these children. We have not provided the kind of services and supports that are really necessary for children who break the law and have serious mental health problems. It's too easy to push the problem aside to a different system. And what we want to say is that when you build capacity within one system, you often cause an incentive to overutilize that system. If you create capacity here, or if you tell OIA here they must provide treatment at treatment facilities, we have the following kind of problems that could result. We have limited psychiatric treatment capabilities in the community. Trillium Family Services, for example, has recently expanded to the Bend area, but at the same time they shut down some beds in the Portland area. There's limited capacity there. If youth offenders are then taking those beds, we have fewer beds available for non-offending youth with serious mental illness, because this doesn't add resources. It simply shifts who's paying for them. And if OIA pays for them, it just means other kids won't have that access. It doesn't address the underlying needs. It also doesn't address kids as they're coming into the system. And what we actually want to do is divert them from custody, not really create a magnet for actually getting kids arrested so that they can then get treatment. And that's a fear I have as well, that this bill will produce. Then there's some technical language difficulties. There's the language of youth to an appropriate treatment facility that tends to imply a facility-based form of care, like psychiatric residential treatment, and evidence-based practices for youth who have both a serious mental illness and who have some criminal behavior is not necessarily congregate care in a facility. It's often, as I think somebody mentioned earlier today, treatment foster care or other forms of care that don't put a child with a whole bunch of other kids where they can learn from each other negative behaviors rather than learning how to manage their illness and focus on good behaviors. And so that's an issue we have. And we concur with Mary Botkin about the language on shall be returned to youth correction facility. That would be in the best interest in our perspective of a youth who has a serious mental health disorder. And I hope I didn't make things simply more confusing, although I fear I have. And I really hope, from the community mental health program's point of view, that what this kind of legislation does is actually encourages people to meet together and try and solve this kind of problem in the interim and in the immediate future. We need additional funding, seriously, for youth who are not Medicaid eligible. That's a huge gaping hole, and it basically gets passed on to other systems. And our kids are not doing well in custody. Thank you.
So I would assume you would agree with Ms. Botkin on having the end of this not only result in going back to a youth facility, but to allow them to go out to community programs.
Absolutely.
Where they work.
Chair Barker, we would concur.
Okay,
yes.
Thank you. Chair Barker, thank you. I'm Phil Lemon. I'm the Deputy Director for the Oregon Youth Authority. With me today is Phil Cox, who's our Treatment Services Administrator. We don't have a position on this bill at this time, but I find very little to disagree with from the two previous speakers, but I do want to make a couple points. This is the third time in the last 12 months that the Oregon Youth Authority has been before this committee or the interim committee to talk about mental health issues in the juvenile justice system. So as I think you know, we haven't fixed things in the last year, and we don't have really an awful lot of new information to bring you today. But just to give you a sense of perspective, the Oregon Youth Authority has custody, legal custody, over about 0.5% of the young people in the state. About 95% don't get in any trouble at all. Another 4.5% are in juvenile department authority, and we have the top 0.5% of that age group. They present very high public safety risks. They present generally very high needs, both in terms of their educational services, their mental health, alcohol and drug, a whole array of issues that they bring. And again, we support the intent of providing access to adequate mental health services for these youth, and we've been working very diligently, we think, to do that. Our basic concern is that currently most of these youth offenders get their services through the mental health system. We provide them directly in our closed custody facilities, but on the community side, most of that is done through the mental health system and through the Department of Human Services. Our concern, and where we may be at a little difference with the sponsors of this bill, is that we do not want to encourage creating a dual mental health system in the juvenile justice system. We think the public and these youth are best served by having the mental health system and the juvenile justice system work together, and there's not an incentive, as Ms. Kimball was stating, not to adjudicate a young person for an offense just because that's the only way to get them services. We think that's not a good precedent to set and not a good practice to have. The only thing I would add that hasn't been brought up already is to clarify that in Section 2, Sub 1 of House Bill 3012, that directs the youth authority to determine the number of offenders in custody or under supervision of the youth authority who require mental health treatment and make information compiled under this subsection available to the public upon request. We already have a biennial, what we call a mental health gap survey, where we take a snapshot of the youth in our custody, identify their mental health needs. That is published. I believe you've had copies of that given to you, and I believe we attached some information with our testimony today. I would just like to make clear that if this bill passes, that we are talking about aggregate information, and we're not talking about youth-specific information. Because otherwise we're going to have to, if that's what you're trying to do and that's what the sponsors are trying to do, then that's going to create other issues and require other statutory amendments. But as long as we're identifying the scope of the problem, we do that now. We're certainly wanting to make that available. And if you're wondering what the answer to that question is, of the approximately 2,000 youth in our custody, about 60% have a diagnosed mental health condition that we think would be subject to this bill. So it is a substantial part of our population. The services they need range from periodic therapy appointments in the community all the way up to short-term stays in acute psychiatric hospitals. And so the needs vary depending on the youth, but it is obviously a major issue that is very intimately involved in our efforts to reform these youth as they leave our custody and return to the community. Be glad to answer any questions.
Any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Yes. Representative Krieger.
Mr. Lemon, it refers to youth offenders with a diagnosed mental illness, and they're referred to as offenders. What about the young people that are not yet an offender, but the parent recognizes something is wrong, they don't fit into this? Where do those parents take their children for help before they become that offender?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, I guess I would defer that question to Ms. Kimball, since we deal with them once they are, first of all, either adjudicated for an offense as a juvenile or convicted of a crime under adult law. And so that's when we see them. Again, our concern is that in some cases, parents or others are told that the kid has to commit an offense and get adjudicated in order to be able to receive services, just because that's what drives it. So with your permission, I'd defer that to someone who probably knows better than I.
Mr. Chair, I think that is another part of the, the equation, is we recognize what we've got when they've already are offender, but we recognize some of them of having problems, and we could head that off if there was something in the process where the public, young people that have children, knew where they could go at a very early stage. Go ahead, if she wants.
Chair Barker and Representative Krieger, if I may address that. Currently, community mental health programs primarily serve a Medicaid population. While they do get some state general fund to serve a non-Medicaid population, it's been severely reduced in the past few sessions, and therefore the ability to meet the needs of non-Medicaid children is very slight. And for those youth who are actually privately insured, which I think constitute up to two-thirds of that youth population in custody, the difficulty we currently have is that private insurance largely is able to put different limitations on mental health services than on other services. So, for example, a child who has a severe mental illness may be able to get a certain number of psychiatric visits, which will care for the sort of medication needs. All the research is showing that for severe mental illness, just like other chronic conditions like diabetes, it takes more than medications to manage it. It often takes education, it takes some support services, and other things that can really wrap around that individual until that illness is sort of under control and they learn to manage it themselves with natural supports. And we don't have that capacity within our current insurance system, and our community mental health system has done that in the past, but the current funding structure is not allowing that. And if I may, there are a few pieces of legislation that do attempt to sort of address this. First, there's a Senate bill on a juvenile PSRB that would possibly help divert some youth from the juvenile justice system or put them under community supervision.
What is PSRB?
Psychiatric Security Review Board.
Okay.
We have that in existence for an adult population, but we don't have it as an alternative to custody for a juvenile population. In addition, we have a House Bill 2362, which would look at the possibility of requiring agencies who serve children to actually focus on children with severe mental illness and blend their funds to wrap around those kids before they actually enter into one of our systems, or in other words, a sort of no wrong door approach, and that's 2362. Where we've been able to successfully divert kids from juvenile justice have been in projects like the Partners Project, which used to exist in the Portland metropolitan area. And in that project, juvenile justice, and I believe Mr. Cox is aware of that program, mm-hmm. and education and child welfare and public mental health all got together and sort of blended funds around high-risk kids, and then regardless of whether they were Medicaid eligible or non-eligible, that was sort of invisible to the family. They got the kind of wraparound intensive services they needed, and you tap into either Medicaid or non-Medicaid and from various agencies to serve that kid. And unfortunately, that's now a rarity, and that's the place we hope to go to, actually.
Okay, thank you. Okay, Mr. Cox, did you want to testify? Or?
Actually, Chair Barker, I was here to respond to any questions you might have.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions? Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I guess.
We won't move this to a work session either. Mary, if you could see if we could come up with a little amendment to that piece you spoke of to move them into, rather than just back into custody. And the next bill we have is House Bill 3071, open a public hearing.
Shetty, gave it to you, didn't she?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Mary Botkin again with the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. This is another bill that tries to address some of the issues of mental illness within the youth correction system. You sort of have to listen to both bills and both, I mean, the testimony sort of overlaps on both sides of this. Here's what we want to accomplish. We want a system that responds quickly and appropriately to the needs of our kids who are in danger, either because of their mental illness or because their environment You know, we have focused on mental illness because that has become one of the areas that we have the least resources to make available to these youthful offenders. And it's one of the areas where we see that we can make some of the best changes and make the biggest headway in diverting these kids from the criminal justice system. And I mean, there's three of you on this committee that were street cops. You know who we're talking about. You know, we all know who we're talking about. And our members face these kids every day and don't have the appropriate housing, they don't have appropriate programs, they don't have enough programs. You know, they get one kid in, they have to bump another kid out. This is not working. The system is failing the people who are trying to provide the services. It's failing the kids who are locked in the system. And the previous speakers are right. The way you get mental health services right now is you commit a crime. And, you know, whether it's appropriate or not, we at least in the criminal justice system provide something. Do we think it's adequate? Do we think it's appropriate? No. All these two bills do is start a process that says we're going to deal with this differently. We're going to try and identify our needs. You know, I think that Phil Lemon and OI have done a great job of putting together some numbers on paper. Do I think that we have everybody captured in those numbers? I don't believe that. You know, you can go to any good kindergarten teacher and she or he will tell you which kids are at risk in their room. But try and access services for those kids and it's going to be difficult. And so we really do need to figure out how we're going to handle this system, when we're going to start. We know that early is better than late. We know that the costs of the victims along the way have resulted in a voting response that has cost the system a lot of money and maybe not even spent it appropriately. We don't know. And I think it's time that we really evaluate what we're doing with the system. And, you know, OIA and I will agree to disagree. I don't think CSD is doing a great job for us.
Amen.
You know, do I think that OIA periodically has some problems? Probably. But I think they do a tremendous job with very little in resources. And I trust them to do what we need to do with these kids. And, you know, if it's through a psychiatric security review board for kids, that's certainly an interesting idea. You know, our folks want to move away from foster care. They don't like foster care because it's hard to get good programming put in place when you have a single placement. You know, they prefer more structured program-based services. And, you know, I don't think we have any serious disagreements between us other than the fact that I don't think CSD is doing a great job, and I'm not going to blame their workforce. I think it's not working very well, and we need to reevaluate what we're doing because I don't think that they're allocating the resources at the ends where we can make the biggest differences. And we do know that we can make a difference with kids. And if we can make a difference with kids, eventually we will make a difference with the adult population. And hopefully we can move in a better direction. And that's all these two bills are trying to do, is to get that discussion to occur in a positive way, to give you all as legislators an ability to say, this is where we would like to head. And, you know, we're not locked into anything that's written in these bills. I mean, I think that everybody wants to accomplish good things. And, you know, Angela and I worked all interim on a committee about managing mental illness in prison. there's a reason we spent all interim working on it, because we're not solving it here, we're not solving it in the community, we're just not solving it. And so in order to get treatment, people end up in the criminal justice system. And whether that's good or bad, you know, we can debate it all day. We have to figure out how we're going to get in front of this issue. And this is our maybe clumsy but earnest attempt at getting there.
Thank you. Any questions?
I have a couple questions, Mr. Chair. Mary, you brought up the subject of CSD. Okay, so might as well drive there a little bit. And I'm not going to get real deep with this. First of all, and this might be a question that I should just probably ask you one-on-one at another time, but
and I think and I'll maybe I'll want to answer one-on-one at another time, but you can ask the question.
Come on.
Okay.
Go for it.
All right. Why do you think CSD doesn't do a great job?
Because I think they're too big. You know, there was a move in the 70s to sort of create this omnibus umbrella of, you know, the Department of Human Resources that created, you know, had all these little ornaments hanging from the umbrella called agencies. It's too big. It has too many things to do anything well. And so what we need to do is figure out how. And this is a huge discussion, Mr. Chair, Representative Olson. This is bigger than me, and probably bigger than one session. It's probably something we need to do in the interim. But I really do think you need to figure out what is it you want them to do, and do you want them to do it well? And there's a reason that we were one of the prime movers many years ago to take OIA out from underneath the banner of CSD. You know, we did not want to compete with abused or neglected children for services and resources for criminal youth, because you lose and you sort of feel bad in the process. I mean, nobody wants to take resources from abused or neglected children to put into youthful offenders. And so we just felt we needed to get away from that, you know, overall group and operate on our own and put ourselves into more of a criminal justice environment. And I think we need to... I think we just need to figure out whether CSD and Department of Human Resources or whatever is capable of handling all the world's problems, or whether we need to break it up again and take a look at having them do some things and doing them well instead of doing everything sort of poorly.
Okay, just a follow-up kind of question that goes alongside the same thing then. Mary, so in the relationship that you're feeling with CSD and with what's happening out there with OIA, and I guess actually a piece that Angela was sharing too as well when she was up here testifying before. Let me just back up and I'll plug this into it. There was a training concept that we always had when I was with the state police, and it was, if it's predictable, it's preventable. And with that concept and plugging that into with what's happening with that relationship for communication, what is it that we can do with CSD to make them improve their relationship or their communication to get into that preventable mode? That's big.
It's big. I'm sorry. I can't even begin. I mean, you know, I think it's arrogant for me to sit on the outside and throw rocks and say, you know, this is what you need to do to fix it. I don't think anybody has a single answer that fixes it. I think it requires everybody kind of putting on their best, you know, their best thinking and sort of, you know, it's a term I get tired of hearing, but thinking outside the box. I mean, it's sort of what we did with Max Williams during the interim with managing mental illness. I mean, one of the things we identified was corrections officers got no training on how to handle mentally ill inmates. They get training on how to handle people who think in a linear process. They understand cause and effect. They understand this is what happens if you do this. When you insert mental illness into this process, with officers with no training, the mentally ill inmate does not think that way. And so it's very challenging. It's no different with kids. I just think kids, we have a much better chance of sort of retraining them to manage their mental illness or to manage their behavioral problems if we start early. And that's the way to fix the other end of the criminal justice system. Otherwise, we're just going to keep building prisons. Mm-hmm. And while that's good for my union, it's probably not the best resource allocation of our time for handling this particular group of folks. And, you know, we need to come up with a better solution. And, again, I say, you know, these bills may not be the know-all and the end-all. They may be drafted a little clumsily because I don't have a college degree. I'm not certified smart in this area. I'm just somebody who's been in the building a really long time, and I'm very frustrated at talking about the same issues session after session after session and not having any solutions. And I can't even imagine what it must be like to be on your side of this table. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes. Murray, I very much appreciate your perspective. I think it's kind of gives some knowledge to us that we hear from you, but like you say, this has been going on for how long? And the same question comes back to me. I think today somewhere in the neighborhood of, 10 or 15% of children are being raised by grandparents. I've had some of that myself. And that's why I asked prior is, if you're a parent or a grandparent and you recognize at an early age, it might be 8, 9, or 10, that this kid's got a problem, and the normal discipline that you're giving him, the strictness, and you're putting him on probation, you put him up against the wall, you can't watch TV, seems to have no effect. You realize there's something more wrong, but where do you go?
I used the Marine Corps myself. they disciplined me very well. You know, I sent them a self-indulgent, spoiled child. They sent home a young man who's been working ever since. But I did not have the challenges that Angela had with her child. I did not have organic brain disorders or something that required a lifetime of management.
But we don't recognize what the problem is because they're not ever evaluated to understand what it is they need, you know. And I guess with 6 kids and I think I got 15 grandkids and 12 foster kids, I've been around a few of them. And they're all different, and they all have different needs, and they seem to react to different types of discipline or encouragement different. And it's not a simple thing to deal with, but I think it might be well if we could explore with Mr. Lemon and yourself and those people who are interested something during the interim to address it, to look at it as a specific issue a little bit deeper than what we have, because when we don't, they end up coming back into the system at some point in their life, the judicial system, the courts, and the attorneys, and that isn't, not only you're talking about the cost, but you're talking about the loss and the lack of quality of life for these young people and the difficulty for the families. So
this is, we're sort of treating these people like throwaway people, like they're disposable somehow. And they do become homeless, and they do become the folks who are wandering the streets. And this is not, you know, when Angela first met me, she was talking about the needs for housing. And I looked at her and I said, I don't understand what your problem is. We have plenty of housing in Portland. And she kind of, you know, didn't understand my funeral humor at that point. And I said, well, we have the parks and the bridges. You know, all we have to, you know, they just move around and under the viaducts. And, you know, that's the issue, though, is that we don't have a full range of services for a client base that can be productive. We don't have a way to sort of move them through the system to being more productive unless they're lucky enough to have an Angela for a mom. And not everybody does. And even when they do, sometimes it doesn't work. Sometimes it fails. you know, and that's the other problem. I mean, the Kip Kinkles of the world, you know, they sort of grab the headlines, but there's thousands of kids that are just a step away whose parents are every bit as smart as his parents were, who could not figure out how to access the services that their kids need. And we need to figure out what we're doing wrong and set about setting that straight.
There are other bills that are out and about, and I don't know what the rate of success, but in talking to NAMI people, who would just, if we had mental health parity in the health insurance, there'd be a lot of support for.
Well, we supported that too.
Yeah. But I mean, those are the kind of things that where maybe there would be some access to care early on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee, for allowing me to sort of go on about this. And you know, we'll figure out what we're going to do, I guess. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Vaughn and Cox and Angela again. Kimmel.
Mr. Chair, members, again, Phil Lemon from the Youth Authority with Phil Cox. Again, don't have much to disagree with Ms. Botkin's statements, and very much appreciate her remarks about the Youth Authority. And frankly, me personally, and I know in the almost 6 months I've been deputy, I've really put a lot of effort into this and think I've made a big difference. But, sorry, kidding. In answer to Representative Krieger's statement of where do kids go if they haven't committed a crime, I would put in a somewhat gratuitous plug on the juvenile crime prevention issue you heard about in two bills previously. When that funding stream was developed in 1999, the specific intent was to take kids before they commit an offense. The statutory requirements are you have risk factors, which includes failing at school, hanging out with the wrong friends, acting out. If they're at imminent risk of getting into the juvenile justice system, then that money is available in each county to address those issues as they are prioritized by that county. So mental health, alcohol and drug, school success, any range of those things, as long as they address a risk factor to prevent that young person from either entering or continuing through the juvenile justice system, that's one of the key components of that program. And so I didn't think of that earlier when I was responding to your question, Representative, but that is one of the specific intentions of doing that, and mental health certainly falls into that. Just to briefly address House Bill 3071, I think that in large part the Youth Authority already is doing what this bill would require us to do. As I mentioned earlier, and we do have the gap analysis that I mentioned in the last bill attached to my testimony today, we do determine the number of youth offenders either in close custody or in community supervision who require mental health treatment due to a diagnosed mental illness. That's about 60% of our overall population, as I mentioned before. Subsection 2 would require us to develop guidelines for identifying the specialized housing needs of those youth offenders with a diagnosis. Depending on what the specific intent of that is, we already, you know, make program assignments based on both the public safety risk, the criminogenic risk factors, as well as the other needs such as mental health, when we assign placements both in our closed custody facilities and in our community placements. We do not have a specialized mental health housing unit or cottage in our closed custody facilities right now. We focus our programming based on the criminogenic risk factors. If there are specific mental health needs, then we deal with those on an individualized basis, but we do not assign housing or programming as a whole based primarily on the mental health issue. So if that is something that this bill specifically contemplates, then we've got some work to do in figuring out exactly how that works. But we do not separate out a mental health population from our general population now. One reason for that is we don't have the same scope and scale and size as Department of Corrections does. Our housing units are based on about 25 youth, and so we have a much more manageable population. If there is a crisis, a mental health crisis that occurs, we do have special units where we send those kids. We can send them to an acute psychiatric facility for stabilization and then transition back. But at this point, we have not determined the need to really separate them out and focus on them in the way that this provision may contemplate. Sub 3 then requires the youth authority to develop and implement individualized treatment plans. Again, we do that. When a youth is committed to our custody, either on probation or enters our closed custody facilities, we have an intake process and a risk needs assessment that identifies, again, the criminogenic risk factors, as well as some of the other needs, whether it's alcohol or drug, mental health, their educational needs. We have an individualized case plan for each one of those youth that sets out in pretty concrete terms what they need to do and how we're going to manage that as they go through our system. So, again, I think we're found nothing to disagree with Ms. Botkin's statements. The only thing I would add is, in response to Representative Olson's questions about and her response about the focus of the agency, that I think is one of our concerns. We are primarily a public safety agency to protect the public, protect the safety of the youth in our custody, and make sure that we are engaging in reformation efforts that get them ready to go back into the public when they're done with our system. The more we focus on mental health and lose the focus on public safety, that would at some point be a concern for us. And that is, again, why our approach would be to make sure that these youth have access primarily in community-based placements, get the services that they need so we can focus on our mission, which is primarily public safety.
You say you already do these things. Would it be helpful to have this law in the books?
Mr. Chair, I frankly don't see a need for it. I think we're already doing it, and unless Ms. Botkin and the other sponsor of this bill have a concern that policy may change in the future, I personally don't see a need for a statutory provision, but again...
Okay. That answers the question. Thank you.
Yes. Just a comment, Mr. Chair. I had the opportunity to go out and visit McLaren Institute, and everything they're talking about right here, I had a chance to see that. So.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, for the record, my name, again, is Angela Kimball of the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs. And we really have no difficulty with this bill. Our understanding is these things already occur within Oregon Youth Authority. Our only comment is this does not address the concerns that Representative Krieger brought up, which is how do you keep individuals with mental illness away from the custody of Oregon Youth Authority to begin with, and how do you help community mental health programs adequately address the needs of these youth in the community where they belong and where they can be reintegrated after release.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Okay, thank you very much. Okay, public hearing on House Bill 3071. Is there any further business this morning? Adjourned.